Royal Fireworks, music plus works by Haydn and Bach. Info at charlottesymphony.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Jumping out of an airplane is not my idea of a good time, but others find it thrilling. Evidently, none more so than our guest later in the hour. She has jumped out of airplanes 20,000 times. It's a record for a woman, and she'll talk about what it means to be the most successful competitive skydiver in the world. But first, we focus on something a lot more serious. Nepal was recently struck by a devastating earthquake. It killed thousands and destroyed homes, historical treasures, and needed infrastructure. That earthquake also triggered an avalanche on Mount Everest. 18 people were killed as snow loosened itself from the mountainside and rumbled downhill, covering everything and everyone in its path. Charlotte and Ashley Stumler was hiking Mount Everest that day. It was the day after her 27th birthday. She survived. Now she's home, trying to move past that horrible moment in time, but also working with others to explain the urgent need by those other survivors who remain in Nepal. Ashley Stumler joins us for the first part of our show this morning. Welcome to the program. Thank you, Mike. We're also joined by Sushil Nepal. He works in Charlotte and moved to the U.S. from Nepal 10 years ago. He's helping to coordinate relief efforts through the Greater Charlotte Nepalese Association. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Mike.
You are not a climber. You're not a mountain climber, Ashley. You went to Mount Everest to hike. Why
yes.
go all the way to the other side of the world to hike?
I think you can only hike Crowder's Mountain here in Charlotte so many times before you got to move on to bigger and better things.
You say you saw this as an adventure. And under normal circumstances, I guess, for a hiker, would this even be considered a dangerous adventure?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a degree of danger, you know, in going this far away. There's, you know, natural disasters all the time. Certainly not something on my radar before I went. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it was a little bit dangerous, but I wasn't considering that when I went.
So when you go to a place like Mount Everest mm-hmm. to climb, you have to take all kinds of special equipment. You've got to train in advance. As a hiker, do you have to do any of that?
I did a little bit of training, just trying to stay in the gym and go on some hikes here before I left. Nothing too intense. I guess I've always been in pretty decent shape, so I was just ready to pack up and try it.
And you planned for this to be a hike of how long? How long were you going to be there?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Hiking all the time or being a tourist part of the time?
Well, I stayed a little bit longer to be a tourist on the front and back end a little mm-hmm. bit. I was trying to save a little room to see Kathmandu.
And when you hike, and I know that we're going to talk about this, you stayed at the base camp that was destroyed the night or two nights, one or two nights before the base camp was destroyed. But when you hike, where do you hike on the mountain? How high do you go? What trails do you, are there trails to follow? Do you have leaders who help? How does it work?
Yes, how it works, usually most people go with a guide. There are plenty of trekking companies in Nepal. So I set it up with a guide beforehand and ended up meeting two other hikers from the States that joined our group. We all three came there on our own for the trip. There's a very outline trail to get there, a lot of villages along the way. We actually stayed just outside a base camp in the town of Gorakshep, mm-hmm. I guess two nights before it happened. But yeah, it's all through a company and very guided.
And the adventure began for you, I think, with the airplane. And we have an airplane pilot here. Maybe she can explain the baggage handling situation behind the scenes. But you lost a bag on the first leg of a 3-flight trip, right?
Yes.
Did that bag ever turn up?
It did. About 3 or 4 days later, I stayed in Kathmandu, and I wanted to go out and do some other things, but every day I had to keep checking back into the airport to see if my bag had made it, and I figured I might be the first person to get to base camp in Birkenstocks in a skirt if my stuff didn't show up.
and then I read that in Kathmandu, the airplane was too heavy, so you had to leave your bags there at the airport. Is that right?
No.
Oh, that's different. Okay. No. Well, I was woefully misinformed. All right. Then you got food poisoning on the first or second night of your stay in Nepal.
Yes, second night.
Some of you, it was bad enough that some of your party had to be airlifted out. You recovered.
Yes.
Did that impact your
No.
At all?
No, he got flown out on the fourth day, or I guess fifth day morning. He hiked all day on the fourth day, really sick, and we were pretty worried. We saw some other people that looked to be in bad shape, too.
So where does the hike begin? Does it begin in Kathmandu, or do you go up toward the base camp on the mountain and begin the hike there? How does it begin?
You begin the flight in this village of Lukla. Mm-hmm. So you fly there on a small plane from Kathmandu, and you start in Lukla, and begin your way all the way through base camp. And you have to stop every few days as you get to a certain altitude just to acclimatize. You'll do a day hike and sleep lower altitude and go on. The whole thing is 2 weeks.
Wow. Yeah. And is there any turning back? Suppose you didn't what if it had become too rigorous for you, or you didn't like it, or you just you had enough? Can you go? Can you turn around? Or
you can,
are you stuck
with a helicopter? That's the only way out. Wow. Or I guess you could hike back. If
so
you
anybody
were able.
Anybody can sign up to do this.
Yeah, I think some people get in over their head, but anybody can.
So how many days into the hike were you when the earthquake struck?
Well, let's see. That was the 25th. I think I was probably 10 days in.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this earthquake was a 7.8 magnitude earthquake. I think it happened on April 25th, if I'm not mistaken. It occurred while you were on the trail before. Had you experienced an earthquake in your past anywhere? Did you know what was going on when it struck?
Not an earthquake that I've ever felt. Mm-hmm. So my first reaction, I was walking up a hill and taking my coat off and looked at my friend and thought I just kind of looked at her confused, thought maybe I was dizzy at first, and realized it got stronger and kept going, and then we realized it was an earthquake and kind of held on to a tree.
I mean, you see pictures of earthquakes in places like California on these security cameras, and you see things falling off grocery store shelves and things. What does it feel like? Did you see it? Could you see the earthquake? Could you see the earth move? Could you feel it? Could you hear it?
Yes, you can hear it, see it, feel it. It's pretty freaky. It's kind of like being in a plane with extreme turbulence, I guess, to describe how it feels. But very confusing at first, and, you know, I didn't realize the extent of it.
How long was the tremor? Do you remember?
How long did it feel?
Really?
It felt like an hour, you know, like it would never stop. But
and then there were aftershocks as well. You were not at base camp at the time. You were what?
A day and a half hike on the way back, yeah.
So did you see any evidence of avalanches while the earthquake was going on, or did you find that out as you went back down the mountain?
I found it out as I went back down the mountain, but the day after the main earthquake, there was an aftershock that I could see an avalanche up high from another village.
Who made the decision, and why did they make the decision to turn around and go back down at the end of the earthquake? Because obviously nobody knew how bad it was on a hiking trail. Why didn't you just keep hiking?
Well, we were on our way back towards Lukla already at that point. We just kind of kicked it into high gear and started walking faster. By the second day, when we realized the extent of the damage and severity, you know, it was kind of like a survival mode kicked in, and I feel like I jogged the 10-mile and stretch. It got pretty scary there after the second day of tremors.
After you saw the extent of the damage.
Yes, yes.
I would guess everybody just wanted to get off.
Yeah, just get off the mountain. But
can you describe what you saw? Did you go back to base camp?
We didn't go back to base camp. No.
Can you describe what you saw? What you saw when you realized? Oh my gosh, this has been a really bad event.
Let's see. In the following hours, we were going through a few villages, and you could see buildings had fallen, large chunks of buildings. There were yaks that fell off cliffs. You know, people were all standing outside, nervous to go back in. And it seemed to get increasingly worse. Each village we passed headed towards our final destination for the night. So we were pretty worried about what we would find in the bigger cities.
Did it get increasingly worse? Because as you come down the mountain, the villages become perhaps bigger and more populated.
They do.
Is that why?
Yeah.
There were more buildings to be destroyed.
Exactly.
Therefore, it got worse on the way down. Mm-hmm. Were your guides at all ever nervous about this before you saw evidence of the destruction? Because I know that there have probably been earthquakes in that part of the world before. They'd probably been through it. Were they worried? Did they seem worried to you?
Our guide did say that it was a really big one from what he's used to. At first, I don't think he was too worried until he kind of started to see some of the same things that we did.
So he was not in radio communication with anybody down below?
Not for a few hours, no.
Wow. Some of the climbers at various base camps had to be lifted out because their trails down the mountain had been destroyed by the avalanche. There was no way back down that they could figure out, or it was too dangerous to go back down that way. How did you get down?
Well, there were some damage to the trails. Luckily, we had come far enough back that avalanches weren't too much of a danger anymore. It was mostly landslides. So parts of trails were taken out by landslides. We would just have to hike a long way around. And on the second day, it was actually pretty crazy. During the second earthquake or big tremor, we had just walked around a big landslide spot and were eating lunch, and another one hit, and we could see yet another landslide even wipe out the way we had come around that right behind us.
That would make me very nervous. What were you thinking? I mean, did you want to finish lunch? Did you want to just get on the trail and get down the mountain?
Wanted to get down the mountain.
Did everybody feel that way? Did the guides feel that way? Was it a quickened pace to get down the mountain?
They wanted to hang around for about 10 minutes to see if there was going to be another one immediately following, and there wasn't. So we definitely had a quickened pace getting back.
And you returned to Kathmandu ultimately, is that correct?
Yes.
Which is where you started. Can you describe the difference in what you saw when you landed in the airplane there to begin your hike versus what you saw when you came back after the earthquake?
It was a completely different city, what we returned to. Landing at the airport, there was all the Air Force planes and helicopters. They were pulling wounded people out of the helicopters on stretchers and bringing them into the airport one after another, like it never ended. So that was our first taste of what we were getting back into. And you could see some of the little tent cities that were set up, you know, as we were about to land.
Let me bring Sushil Nepal into this. He's a relief effort coordinator with the Greater Charlotte Nepalese Association here, and he's been in this country for 10 years, but obviously grew up in Nepal. Talk to me about Kathmandu, which is, I guess, the capital and one of the largest cities, which had the most infrastructure in Nepal. How many people live there?
Kathmandu, like you said, Mike, it's the capital. Over 1 million people.
Mm-hmm.
It's the densely populated city and only bigger city in Nepal. It's a very historic town. It was built many, many years ago before there were building codes. A lot of the building are built with traditional traditional carving, wood and like stone and mud.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the buildings that sustain more damage than the newer structure that were built to withstand some of the earthquake.
Do you know how bad the destruction is, and I'm not sure how to ask the question. How terrible things are even today at this point.
There is a lot of damages in historic parts of Kathmandu. There were several UNESCO heritage sites in Kathmandu. Those are probably 70% of the stock is damaged, but the damage is outside Kathmandu, in villages, the small towns, more than the capital.
We'll come back and talk more about that in just a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and ABZ Creative Partners, marketing and communication strategists committed to helping businesses succeed. Creative, scalable solutions and strategic advice available at abzcreative.com. And Heartwood Tree Service. Heartwood Tree celebrates spring online at heartwoodtree.com, featuring their latest newsletter and details about the upcoming Tour de Tree bike event, or Tour des Trees bike events. All online at heartwoodtree.com. Motherhood has never been easy, but today moms sometimes feel overwhelmed with their kids' busy schedules, work, meals, monitoring what their child sees on the internet, what they watch on TV. The media, well, we're not always helpful, and sometimes social media can make moms feel like they don't measure up or they aren't doing it right, whatever that means. So we'll meet three women, all mothers, who help other moms with tips on how to manage the mom marathon tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, millions of millennials graduate from high school and college this spring. Studies show they want more flexibility than previous generations and are likely to change jobs more frequently. Millennials in today's workforce and the job outlook for new grads.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ashley Stumler is our guest in this part of the program. She was a Charlottean hiking on Mount Everest the day of the earthquake, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake in Nepal. Sushil Nepal is also with us. He's a relief effort coordinator for the Greater Charlotte Nepalese Association. You volunteered at a hospital, Ashley, I'm told, shortly after you got back to Kathmandu. What kinds of injuries were you seeing? How many people were in that hospital? How overwhelmed were the medical personnel there?
The hospital was pretty packed, but from what I hear, not as bad as it was in the first couple days before I had arrived.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty overwhelmed, but they seem to have a system. So volunteering was a little bit of a challenge. My friend Caitlin that I was with there, she is a nurse, an ER nurse. So she had some very valuable skills, and she even found it a little bit hard to kind of jump in with the system. So overall at this hospital, I think they were managing things pretty well.
The language barrier? If you're trying to volunteer at a hospital, what about the language barrier?
There were a lot of people that speak English,
okay, right.
So that was helpful.
you then took shelter, I'm told, in the Turkish embassy where there was no cell service, but you were able to get messages to your family out on Facebook. Now, how if there's no cell service, how do you get access to the wired internet? The wires stayed up?
Well, it's actually the U.S. Embassy, but they...
Where did I get this information?
I don't know. Like, Turkish Embassy, I wonder what that was like. But the cell service didn't work. You're not really supposed to use your phone in the embassy, or you can get it taken away. But they had libraries with computers, so I was able to get on Facebook
there. So the infrastructure for the wired internet still existed, or did they have satellite internet or something at the U.S. Embassy?
I'm not sure what they had, no.
Nepal has been described, Sushil, as barely developed. What does that mean?
That means we are behind in terms of infrastructure and regulations to have a city like here in USA. So,
is that because most of the country is remote and rural and comprised of villages scattered throughout mountainous regions?
That plays a bigger role. I mean, Nepal is such a small country, but the elevation varies from 300 feet all the way up to 29,000.
Mm-hmm.
So with that high rising elevation, there is difficulty with terrain and topography to build towns and villages. So like I think Ashley mentioned, most of the areas there are trails to hike, and that's the only way to get to the villages.
Mm.
And that was one of the biggest challenges for rescue outside Kathmandu was you had no other ways other than just walking.
So there are no roads for motor vehicles. Mostly it's hiking trails.
Correct.
And in cases where there were roads, some of those roads had evaporated because they were destroyed by the earthquake and avalanches, or covered over by avalanches.
They were destroyed by earthquake, and then the rain happened immediately afterwards, then a lot of landslides.
Hmm.
So that took away roads, and we also heard a lot of horror stories that the relief workers that went to help were buried in landslides. So a lot of damages haven't happened even after the earthquake.
I know that you have been encouraging people to help the people of Nepal, and you're doing this through the Greater Charlotte Nepalese Association. I read that yesterday, and I thought, really? We have a Greater Charlotte Nepalese Association. Who knew? How many people from that part of the world live here?
We have, and we're always careful to distinct, we have over 5,000 people of Nepalese origin. Mm-hmm. So that means you probably heard we got refugees from Bhutan, and there are folks that are directly from Nepal. So those are both combined, and they have some origin to Nepal. The Greater Charlotte Nepalese Association is it's an informal organization. We started several years ago, but we were in the process of creating a nonprofit 501c3, and then this happened. Mm-hmm. So we partner with a national nonprofit to collect funds and channel funds through them back to Nepal.
The Samaritan's Purse organization has been active in sending help, as have other organizations, but some people have been complaining that the relief monies that they're sending and the goods that they're sending are sometimes not getting through to the people who need them because of red tape on the part of the Nepalese government. I heard yesterday that that's improving somewhat. Is that red tape deliberate, or is it incompetence, or is it because they're simply not set up to handle something on this scale?
I think I'm going to say the latter, because they're not set up to respond to disaster like this. We are already a developing country with limited resources. When something like this happens, you're overwhelmed, and there might be some challenges with folks, but I think overall it is pretty much, I would say, they were not prepared.
You still have family there, is that correct?
Yes, I do.
Where are they?
My parents are in Kathmandu, and my extended family is all over.
So what have you heard from them and other members of your family? Are they okay? Have some of them been hurt? Have they had property damage? Are they suffering?
Fortunately, no casualties within mm-hmm. our family and friends. Definitely heard some property damage, but nothing to a very bad extent.
And I read that one of the reasons that Nepal is struggling so much is that much of the country has been impacted by this. I'm not sure what the percentage of the country is, but how much would you say has been impacted? Is there damage everywhere in all the villages and all the towns?
Not everywhere, but to give you a perspective, epicenter of the 7.8 magnitude was 40 miles away from Kathmandu. So I think the sphere of influence was probably around 125 miles from the center. So Mount Everest area is just over 90 miles if you're directly measuring from the epicenter.
Give us an idea of how big the country is. I mean, is it as big as North Carolina? Is it smaller than North Carolina?
I think if I had to compare, I would say state of Arkansas. Okay. Just a little bit bigger than that in terms of land area.
So you mentioned that there have been landslides, of course, the avalanches, roads been destroyed. And at first, the government of Nepal did not have enough small – they had army helicopters, but they didn't have enough small helicopters to get into these remote areas. The big helicopters couldn't land. They were too big. Is that situation improving to the best of your knowledge?
Yeah, what I'm hearing from the ground, it is improving. There is more help from international community, U.S. And our neighboring countries like India, Pakistan, all of the resources are now coming in, and help is getting to the remote areas.
Do we know if most of the remote areas have been reached by outside help yet, or are there still areas perhaps that have not been reached?
I would say there are still some left.
And would those be areas at higher elevations or in particularly difficult remote mountainous locations? Is that
yes,
why?
Yes, those will be. Pretty much like I said earlier, it's because there's no way to get there other than just the air. Mm-hmm. And with limited helicopters, you got to prioritize. And even with prioritization, you can only do so much when you don't have a lot of resources.
When you look at destruction on this scale, where buildings have collapsed, roads have collapsed, water systems have stopped working, electricity is not working properly. When you're not sure of conditions from the outside looking in because the communications are out, how do you know how to coordinate relief efforts? How do you know what is needed? How do you know where it needs to go? I mean, where do you even begin?
Well, I mean, like any disaster, you got to make a decision at that point with whatever information you have. Luckily, we had our ground resource back in Kathmandu that we've been working for other activities even before earthquake. We always have been involved in charities and relief efforts in villages, building schools. We sent funds through Greater Charlotte, so we had a contact back in Kathmandu. So they were our eyes on the ground, so they gave us ideas of what was the immediate need. The immediate needs were medical needs, mm-hmm. rescue, and treating people that were injured by the earthquake. So we knew that, so we started sending help right away.
Now, you arrived in this country 10 years ago to study urban planning at the University of Iowa and now are the principal planner for the town of Huntersville.
Correct.
Now, tell me why somebody from DePaul wants to come to the United States to become a town planner.
Well, it was not planned that way. 10 years ago, I got the opportunity to come to University of Iowa as an exchange student through the university back home. Just to come for 6 months, learn about the United States, take a few classes, and pretty much enjoy life.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I was offered a full scholarship to go to grad school, and I had interest in urban planning, so that's where it started, and since then it has not stopped.
And as I said, you're the principal planner for the town of Huntersville. Any plans to go back? It seems to me that particularly at this stage, Nepal could use somebody of your talents.
I would think so. Yes, there is a lot of help needed in Nepal. I do not have immediate plans, but we do hope to coordinate those efforts throughout the coming months. There are planners and architects back in Nepal, and there are skilled crafters that we still have a group of people that help build those structures. Those are like families, generations that do build historic structures in Kathmandu. So eventually, if I get opportunity, yes. But I think the challenge is going there right now. People will need to cater to me, and I take resources away from what's needed there.
Right.
So I think it's best for me to stay here, and it is difficult, but try to do what I can do from here.
How can people help?
The easiest way at this point is fundraising. That's what we're focusing on. Is collecting funds. We did Vizzle last week here at International House, and fortunately we were able to collect over 15,000 right on site within few hours. So we're doing that throughout last week, and we're going to continue that.
And how does that money get back into the economy and the relief efforts in Nepal?
So the way we have it structured, so we collect funds here locally, and then we send it to the nonprofit I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. called Global Nepali Professional Network, which is based in U.S., but their parent organization is in Nepal. So we channel through them. So it's not going to Red Cross or other bigger organizations because we won't be able to track where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So we send it to them, and they're working with very local grassroots agencies back in Nepal to send not send money, but buy goods and distribute. So we know that funds are going where it's needed the most.
So you set out on what was going to be just a nice little diversionary adventure, Ashley Stumbler.
Yes.
And lived through this earthquake. There were people that you met along the way who didn't survive. How do you deal with that?
It's been kind of tough, and that's why part of me is just trying to move forward with my life and just do what I can to help send funds to Nepal and help rebuild and do what I feel is my part and kind of helping where I can.
Ashley Stumbler is a Charlottean who's hiking Mount Everest the day the earthquake struck. Sushil in Nepal is a relief effort coordinator for the Greater Charlotte Nepalese Association and a principal planner, town planner, for the town of Huntersville. Thank you for sharing your story. I appreciate it very much. And thank you for joining us,
Mike.
As well, Sushil.
Thank you.
For some, flying in an airplane seems like tempting fate. Jumping out of one just seems crazy. But for others, skydiving is a thrill, a skill to be mastered, and an event to repeat over and over again. No woman has repeated that feat more than our guest for the rest of the hour. Cheryl Stearns is a pilot and a competitive skydiver, the first female member of the Golden Knights, the U.S. Army's elite parachute team. She has 30 world records in parachuting and 20,000 skydives. To her credit, the first woman to achieve that. And Cheryl Stearns joins us for the remainder of the program. Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much, Mike.
You were 17 years old, 10 years younger than Ashley, when you made your first parachute jump. What made you want to do it? I know I read that you had saved up your allowance and you'd saved up whatever money you were making at a 25-cent an hour job, and you put it all toward this skydive. Why?
It was something I always wanted to do. I wanted to know what it was like to fall off an airplane.
Why?
Going 120 miles an hour. I mean, it's the curiosity of fear. You know, you never want to be dropped as a baby. And always, if I have some sort of fear, I try to get educated, get some knowledge. And I just had this, you know, anxiety, something I wanted to know what it was like to fall and go 120 miles an hour.
Do you remember what was going through your head the moment before you took that first jump? Any second thoughts? Maybe I don't want to do this. Maybe I should turn around and just sit back down and let the airplane land.
No, not at all. The problem was back in 42 years ago, we had static line. And so you only fell 8 feet because you're attached to an 8-foot line.
And when the line got to the end of the thing, it pulled open your chute.
And that was it. And so I rode a parachute down. I said, well, this is not what I wanted. So I had to continue to jump to get to the free fall, which took about 20 jumps to get to do a 30-second free fall to where I could see everything and feel everything and not have sensory overload. And at that point in time then, I was around a lot of other jumpers that were my mentors. They were older than me. They were pilots. And I found out about competition. I was a high school tennis player. And I decided, well, maybe I'll just go into competition here. And I just fell in love with the sport.
I didn't know
until I couldn't quit.
I didn't know until I read about you that there was such a thing as competitive skydiving. I had no idea that. But
I didn't either. I just went out to make one jump, and 42 years later, 20,000 jumps, I've made more. But I got into the competition part, and that's where I've been ever since.
Now, you were 17.
Yes.
You saved your own money for this jump. I don't know what a jump cost, but I think back then I think I read it cost
$40. $40 to make your first one.
To make that first jump. And you went and had to do several more before you could qualify for the free, what did you call it?
The free fall.
The free fall, where you aren't tethered to the airplane. You just jump, and when you decide, you pull the ripcord and the chute opens. That's a lot of money for a 17-year-old. You footed the bill yourself?
My mother paid for the first $40, and then I paid for everything else after that. But I also went out there and worked. I packed some parachutes. And where I really earned my money was what I would say dollar on the disc. So whoever was riding up with me, we would back then we had a 10-foot diameter. We were jumping around parachutes. And I said, whoever's the closest pays each person a dollar.
The closest to the landing spot?
To the landing spot. And at that time, it was $2 a jump. And so I didn't have the money to pay. So it was survival for me. So that's where I became really, really good in accuracy because I couldn't afford to lose.
We're going to talk about this accuracy thing because it's astounding what you have to do. We'll talk about it in a second. But you're 17 years old. Your mother gives you the first $40. Why? Why would she let her daughter jump out of an airplane?
Well, she signed the permission slip. My father didn't want anything to do with that. But, you know, I bugged her enough for a year, and she finally she trusted me completely. And then, you know, I also taught her how to fly and everything. So she was adventurous in her own way.
Well, your father tried to talk you out of this by offering to pay for
flying
lessons. You took him up on that, I take it.
I did. It took him 3 years to pay the bill off, and he was trying to divert. I didn't know, but he told me 8 years later that he was trying to divert my attention away from skydiving and maybe go another road, not realizing I would do both roads.
And she has done both roads with 20,000 skydives to her credit, and also you're a pilot for U.S. Airways, flying those big
planes. Big airplanes.
Well, we'll talk about that and about competitive skydiving with Cheryl Stearns when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, celebrating 75 years of providing leadership in the field of neurosurgery on a local and national level. Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates is on the web at cnsa.com. And Central Piedmont Community College's Collegiate Test Prep, offering evening GRE exam preparation classes starting June 1st at CPCC's Central Campus near Uptown Charlotte. Details at collegiatetestprep.com. Millions of millennials graduate from high school and college this spring, and studies show that they want more flexibility than previous generations and are likely to change jobs more frequently. Millennials in today's workforce and the job outlook for new grads, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at WFAE at charlottetalks at WFAE.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we're coming right back.
Coachella, you've heard of. Lollapalooza is another music festival, but Sasquatch?
If somebody has a plot of land and a checkbook, they can suddenly find themselves in the festival business.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Music festivals, take your pick. There are plenty of them. That story next time on Marketplace from APN.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Cheryl Stearns is with us, a Charlottean who is the first female member of the Golden Knights U.S. Army's elite parachute team with 30 world records, 20,000 skydiving jumps to her credit. And she's a pilot for U.S. Airways, soon to be American Airlines. Here's something I didn't know about competitive skydiving, which you found out about as a teenager in Arizona. And here's something else I didn't know. I didn't know that the world-renowned skydiving coach, Jean Paul Thacker, located here in North Carolina, and you moved from Scottsdale, Arizona to Rayford to work with him at a very young age. Why was he here?
He was actually the first member of the Army parachute team back in 1959 when the organization started. And so he retired from the military and started this drop zone in Rayford. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go be a world champion in skiing, you go to the mountains in Colorado or some other place with big mountains. Or if you want to be a world champion in skydiving, you went to Rayford, North Carolina, because he was there. He was a coach, and people from all over the world came to train there because he had the facilities, he had the airport, he had everything
and
available.
You had a lot of gumption because you wrote him and you said, I don't have any money for this.
Right. I had 450 jumps, 450 hours, and said, I wanted to be a world champion, but I didn't have any money. And all I have is a dog and a parachute, $50 in my pocket. So he came, he wrote back and said, come on, I won't let you or your dog starve, and we'll give you a shot. So I expected to stay a month and left my flying job in Arizona, and I've been here 42 plus years, you know, in North Carolina, never went back.
You know, people, to do what you do, to get the experience that you need to be a competitive skydiver and to be as accomplished as you are, you have to jump all the time. I read that there was a day that passed where you jumped, what, 365 times or something like that?
352 jumps in 24 hours.
24
hours. That was a Guinness Book of World Records. That was strictly to go out and make jumps and shoot accuracy at the same time.
Did you have to pay for all those jumps? Because it's $40 a jump.
I had to pay for the T-shirts that I gave to all my support crew. That was 120 folks, but everything else was sponsored. And then the only people that, you know, help me out, got a T-shirt and sweatshirt.
So let's talk about competitive skydiving, because I didn't know anything about it until yesterday. What are the parameters? Are there different events? Are there different types? Like if you're a diver in a swimming pool,
right,
there's different kinds of events that you're judged on, and the judges sit poolside and watch you. Are there different kinds of events in skydiving, and where do the judges watch from?
There are so many events now. When I started, we had called the classic is the style and the accuracy, mm-hmm. and we landed on a 10 centimeter disc. And now, through the years with our equipment change, it's now 2 centimeters, the size of a nickel. And then that's the accuracy portion, and then the free fall portion was style. It was you jumped out at 7,500 feet. You dove down 15 seconds, build up your speed about 200 miles per hour, and you did a series of turns and loops to race against the clock. And back then, they judged you by telemeters, and you had a recorder, and the guy just talked, and there's no video of any sort. Now, with our technology, we have big cameras. We video you from ground-to-air cameras. So we still have those events, but those are slowly going out for the style because of the expense of the equipment. And then with our change of our equipment that we have from the military equipment where I learned to jump on, where we could get cheap, we now have very small equipment, different size canopies for different size people. And now we have different disciplines where they have the swooping, where you go across the pond with the water. They do accuracy, speed. I mean, the world record there is 93 miles per hour under a canopy. Mm. And they have free fall, four-way, eight-way. and they have canopy relative work where they build big formations, and now they do head down where they build formations where everybody's on their head instead of on their belly. So equipment has helped us change. Video, looking at video, help us improve the speed of learning.
I want to get back to this accuracy thing, because when you jump out of an airplane, how high are you?
Normally for accuracy, it's like 3,000 feet, and we put out five people for a team, and then we have to stack it.
And I would think that there's so many things that go into being able to land, not on a dime, but on a nickel.
Yes.
Seriously, it's the size of a nickel. Your foot has to hit that nickel.
Right, your heel.
And for every X number of measurements away from that nickel, you are what? You lose a point?
Well, we have a pad that's electronically scored, and it's 16 centimeters in diameter. So it's like a big pie plate. And we land on a air tuffet or a foam tuffet. And because we kind of at the bottom of the last 2 feet, you want to come straight down so you have a real good strike on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's basically landing like a glider without an engine or an airplane without an engine. So we're working with the wind conditions, the thermals, the crosswinds, headwinds. We don't want to land tailwind. We want to land into the wind.
Mm-hmm.
So you can break your, guide your canopy. And then so you want to land with zero rate of descent, zero forward speed, and put your foot right in the middle.
So how much of it has to do with where the airplane is when you jump out of it?
Well, you are in charge of where you're going to get out, depending on the winds. And then you get out there, and then you fly your canopy back. So you want to get out upwind.
But when you look down, what do you see from the airplane? I mean, you have to know where the thing is. I mean, it's the size of a nickel.
Yeah, you can't see that. Yeah, you can see the tuffet. The tuffet's big. It's 10 meters in diameter. And then the only time I can actually see the nickel size 2-centimeter target, it's yellow target on black.
Mm-hmm.
I can see it about 5 feet away. So just about the point I'm ready to transition is where I can see it. Otherwise, I'm looking at the pad itself and keeping that lined up with my closure rate and keeping it right between my legs and not left or right.
Are you the best in the world at this?
Yes, I am.
That was a quick answer. The best in the world. What does that feel like? The best in the world.
I don't have an ego, and I just do. It's something I love. I have the drive for it, and I love coaching. I love to see my students excel, and one of these days they'll start beating me, and that will be it's a challenge. The thing is, it's a constant challenge. It's thoroughly enjoyable. It's not adrenaline out there. It's just a challenging sport. The people that are in it are phenomenal. They would come from all different worlds, all different skills and jobs, and they're different. It's a close knit group.
You talked about initially as a beginner, you wanted to feel what it felt like to fall.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why you wanted to do this. Now you're a competitive skydiver, the best in the world. Your accuracy is unbelievably good because you have to hit that nickel-sized thing, and you do it over and over and over and over again. But to do that, you can't just be thinking, "Oh, this feels fun, all this free falling." You've got to be aware of everything around you.
Everything. I mean, it's everywhere from Mother Nature, the winds, and my. Where my mind is, where my body is, and you've got to be there. You got to be totally focused. Otherwise, it's a split second, and you've missed.
Well, as you're falling, I don't know how fast you fall. What, 90 miles an hour, 120 miles an hour?
Before I open, from 3,000 feet, I'm only falling about 90 miles an hour.
So how can you feel what the wind is doing? Because you're falling through the air, and all you're hearing is air rushing past you. How do you know what the wind is doing?
Well, you know from now we got GPS stuff, we get information from the weather, but you can look at the airplane and see how fast it's moving, but for me, when I'm under canopy, I can tell my speed against the ground, like ground speed. Am I moving forward or am I not moving forward?
Has your chute ever not opened?
I have 16 malfunctions and all that, and most of them were in the old days between the ramp. When we started the squares, between the round and the squares, when we trying to figure out deployment systems. So most of them go back way, way back, but I haven't had one in thousands of jumps.
When that happens?
We have a reserve,
yeah.
And it has to be specially packed by a a rigger that's FAA certified, you know, like a pilot certified, and those don't fail. And, you know, you just cut away. Where they have issues, people have issues, is they don't do the right sequence. They don't do the emergency procedures right.
In other words, you have to position your body correctly.
You have to have a position right. You can't be too low to the ground, pull too low, and now you don't have enough time to have the reserve open. But if you do everything by the book right, it's not a problem.
Well, I read that you had one incident where your chute didn't open and you pulled the emergency chute, but you did it incorrectly and you did it almost too close. 1 second later.
I did it too slow.
Yeah.
I went methodically through the steps too slow, not realizing I was still going 125 miles an hour, you know. And so I only had 10 seconds, and it took me 8 seconds to go through the whole procedures.
Wow.
In which normally now it takes me less than a second. I do it.
And you landed on the ground pretty shook up, and you got right back in an airplane and jumped again.
I had to. If I didn't, I wouldn't have been able to get back
in. It's like falling off a horse. If
yes.
you don't get back up, you'll never get back
That's
up.
That's true.
Wow. It seems to me that there would be some people out there who would look at somebody like you, a professional skydiver, and also an Army skydiver, as somebody who's kind of a daredevil, because you're tempting fate in their minds. We'll talk about the safety aspect of this, but you're tempting fate. And so I wouldn't necessarily think that you'd be a good candidate to pilot a commercial airline.
Well, not that's not so, because one thing, I don't exceed my limits of any sort. I know what my limits are, and safety is my number one concern, and I do everything pretty much by the book. Yes, I bend some rules just like everybody else, but I don't exceed those limits.
Do you think your understanding of being a human being falling through the air, landing on a nickel, makes you a better airplane pilot?
It does, absolutely, because every time I'm landing my airplane, it's like landing my canopy. That's why I'm so good in the parachuting part, because I actually get double amount of training out there. But mm-hmm. I got an engine I can work with, and as they say, it's I'm aware. I don't safety is very important for me. So flying, I don't push the limits on anything. I know it can bite me. I don't parachuting. If I don't respect the sport, if I don't respect flying, it will bite me. And so I don't go there.
You were the first woman to be allowed into the U.S. Army's elite parachute team, mm-hmm. the Golden Knights. Was that a tough thing to break into? Did they welcome you with open arms? Had you had some records to your credit before you went in? How did they view you? Because this was a while back. I don't know what year.
Yeah, it was. You know, it took 2 years. I had to convince Washington also, because of being the first pilot, per se, first parachutist on the Army team. It took 2 years to convince Washington. It took 2 years to convince the Army team that I'd be a great ambassador for the Army. And I jumped with them. I jumped against them. I taught many of the team members how to fly airplanes. And they realized that, you know what, she's good, she's great, and if we're going to eventually, we're going to have a woman, and she would be a great ambassador for the Army team.
Now, are the Golden Knights, are they just a demonstration parachute team, or are they a combat team?
No, they're they're public relations. Mm-hmm. We fall under the public relations for the Army, so recruiting command. Mm. So it's a way of recruiting, and we have a competition team, a tandem team, you know, two demonstration teams. So we go all over the country.
And in competition, evidently, it's not just a matter of jumping out of an airplane and landing on that nickel one time. In Yugoslavia, I read that you hit the same spot in a field 18 consecutive times. Was that part of the competition, to see how many people could do it that many times?
No, the only way you can get a world record is at a national or international meet. You have to have 5 FAI judges there to certify it. So you make 10 jumps at a competition. So the least amount of total you have at the competition, you're the winner. Uh-huh. But if you consecutively keep making dead centers, now the record at that time was 7 dead centers in a row. Well, I already had 10, so they allowed me to keep going until I actually missed. But I ran out of time. I only went up to 18, and we said, you know, the whole meet was over with by then.
Right.
And they said, we now have to do the awards. So
you won't jump through clouds. Why not?
Well, I can't see the ground. You know, that now you're getting into a safety issue. Mm-hmm. I don't have GPS on me, and I don't know what's in there, what's around there, what airplanes are in there. So I want to be able to see where I am, where I'm landing, and what's
and
up there.
And the reason I ask that is because you've done a lot of exhibition skydiving for events like the Super Bowl and flying around the Statue of Liberty and through the St. Louis Arch with a parachute. And you also did a special event for the 1980 Olympic Games in Lake Placid. Should skydiving, it sounds to me very much like water diving in many cases, should skydiving be an Olympic sport?
We have tried for 40 years to get in the Olympics.
What's why are they?
We don't understand. We even jumped it in Seoul, Korea, and built the rings just to, you know, demonstration-wise of what we can do. There's so much now with technology that can be done that you can see us in the air instantly.
Are they perhaps afraid that there would be a terrible accident on television worldwide?
I don't know. We rarely have issues, and most of them are with inexperienced people or, you know, learning.
You have done all these successful jumps, and yet you had a terrible accident on your bike. You were training for an event that was going to take place in Dubai, and you were riding around Charlotte on your mountain bike and got hit by a car.
Yes, that was in November.
And that put you out of commission for quite a while because you had a severe concussion. You couldn't go up in an airplane because they wouldn't let you medically. So how are you today?
Well, in that accident, I had a moderate traumatic brain injury. The rest of my body was all right, pretty much, and I'm out of work for a year, minimum of a year, but I'm doing fine. I didn't lose motor skills, cognitive issues, you know, problem solving, some other little issues, but I'm about 90% there.
People should know that you are 30 times more likely to die riding a bike every year than from skydiving, and your chances of texting while driving and dying as a result are 130 times greater than dying while skydiving.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Cheryl Stearns, congratulations on your incredible